Coming up on this week's book show, Pulitzer Prize winner Rick Atkinson, who wrote the best-selling Liberation Trilogy about the American effort in Europe during the Second World War, has now written the first book in a new trilogy to tell the story of the war that made America. It's called The British Are Coming, The War for America, Lexington to Princeton, 1775 to 1777. Rick Atkinson on this week's book show. Welcome to the book show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Rick Atkinson, who wrote the best-selling Liberation Trilogy about the American effort in Europe during the Second World War, has now written the first book in a new trilogy to tell the story of the war that made America. The new book is called The British Are Coming. The first volume of Atkinson's Revolution Trilogy recounts the first 21 months of America's violent war for independence. From the battles at Lexington and Concord in spring 1775 to those at Trenton and Princeton in the winter of 1776-1777, American militiamen and then the ragged Continental Army take on the world's most formidable fighting force. Again, the new book is The British Are Coming, The War for America, Lexington to Princeton, 1775 to 1777, and it is a great pleasure to welcome Rick Atkinson to this week's book show. What a great pleasure to have you on the program, sir.
Well, thank you, Joe. I'm really pleased to be here.
Was it a natural progression, at least for you, in your scholarship and your interest, going from World War II to the Revolution?
I'd say it was kind of unnatural. You know, I finished the third and final volume of my Liberation Trilogy, which is about the American role in the liberation of Europe in World War II. And as I'm getting close to the end in 2013, thinking about what to do next, the obvious, the natural progression would be to pivot to the Pacific and do for that theater what I'd done for the Mediterranean and Western Europe. And I just didn't have the heart for it, partly because I would have had to start the war over again at Pearl Harbor or even before that. Consequently, thinking about what it was I wanted to do, I have to say my eye was just drawn to the story that has beguiled me since I was a kid, and that is our creation story. You know, the story of the Revolution tells us who we are, where we came from, what our forebears believed, and probably the most important question any people can ask themselves, what they were willing to die for. So that's what I decided to do. I thought that in part it would also, since I'd spent so much time looking at the military of the 20th and to some extent the 21st century, that this would allow me to go back and see the origin story of, for example, the U.S. Army.
Give us a context of where we're at.
Yeah, well, there is a prologue, and it actually begins in June 1773. It's set entirely in England. And we are with the king, King George III, who is traveling to Portsmouth on the south coast of England because there's a four-day celebration of the Royal Navy. He's inspecting the fleet. It's a national holiday, basically, in Britain. And it's an opportunity to see, first of all, who they are and what it is they believe. George is he's been king since 1760. He came to the throne at the age of 22. And in 1773, it's 10 years precisely after the creation of the first British Empire with British victory over the French, the Spanish, in the Seven Years' War, which we call the French and Indian War. And they'd gotten enormous territorial gains, Canada, Sugar Islands in the West Indies, India, a billion fertile acres west of the Appalachians in what would become the United States. 1773 is the year that the phrase, the sun never sets on the British Empire, was coined. So we spend quite some time with George at this festive event, understanding the frictions that are building with the American colonies, things that have happened, including the Boston Massacre in 1770, the Boston Tea Party will happen in December 1773, various punitive measures taken by the British, and then, of course, it all erupts in gunplay at Lexington and Concord, April 19, 1775, and that's where the book proper begins. I'm a military historian. I write about war. I write about battle, and this book is largely about battle.
What is the state of our fighting force at this point?
Well, it's poor. American colonies have militias. There are a fair number of militiamen who've had some experience fighting in the French and Indian War. But it's a pretty ragtag outfit, particularly in New England. There have been efforts to bolster the militia and have them train more and to ensure that they have decent leadership. There is no Continental Army until after the war begins. And in July 2nd, 1775, George Washington arrives to take command of the new Continental Army in Cambridge outside of Boston. The British have been chased back into Boston after Lexington and Concord, and the Continental Army is besieging them, basically. Washington had had 5 years of experience in uniform as a Virginia militia colonel under British superior officers, but it's been 17 years, really, since he's been in uniform. There's a lot he doesn't know about artillery and cavalry and finding the provisions and logistics for a continental force. So he has a very steep learning curve, and his entire army has a steep learning curve. And the indiscipline is a terrible problem, and desertion is a terrible problem. So he's building the airplane as he's flying it, trying to put together a force that is capable of going toe-to-toe with the British Army, which is one of the most disciplined, one of the most ferocious forces in the world. And the Royal Navy is here in force. Almost half of the Royal Navy will be in American waters. And it's the greatest navy the world has ever seen. We have no navy. That just compounds the problems that the rebels have in prosecuting this insurrection.
The title of the book is The British Are Coming. Where does that come from? Because that is not something that would have been said at the time.
Well, that's true. I mean, it's been claimed that Paul Revere was shouting that as he rode through the countryside outside of Boston on the night of April 19th, 1775, to alert the colonials that the British Army was coming out. They were headed to Concord. They intended to take possession of munitions that they knew to be stored there. Revere would not have yelled that because it wouldn't have made any sense to people who were really British subjects. What he probably shouted, he's quoted as saying over and over again, the regulars are coming out, the regulars meaning the British Army. I use the title metaphorically because it really is what this book is about. It's what the first 2 years of the war are about. The British Army is coming in force. So is the Royal Navy. They're bringing 30,000 Hessian German mercenaries, and they're coming to burn your towns, to kill your men, to rape your women, and to otherwise do what is necessary to suppress this rebellion. It's that ferocious. And so the idea of sitting in New York or Boston or South Carolina and knowing that this formidable force is coming and that you've committed yourself to fighting it is a pretty terrifying thought to many people.
Pulitzer Prize winner Rick Atkinson is our guest. The new book, The British Are Coming, The War for America, Lexington to Princeton, 1775 to 1777. Let us spend a few moments on George Washington. You, as many historians before you have done, have painted the picture of this man as a brilliant general and a brilliant man. And yet there are some fundamental issues to his leadership as a general. Bring us to, because one of the things I find surprising is just him coming to New England. You remind us he's a Virginian and he's a little skeptical of New Englanders.
Yeah, you know, I had the privilege of living metaphorically with Dwight Eisenhower for 15 years and writing about World War II, and I grew to admire him more with each passing month. And I feel somewhat the same way about Washington. The two have in common the fact that they're not particularly good battlefield generals. They don't see the battlefield spatially and temporally the way a great captain like Napoleon does. Washington makes many mistakes tactically. He learns from those mistakes, but the mistakes cost men their lives, and it's painful to see Washington at times. He does arrive in July 1775 as a Virginian in charge of a mostly New England force, mostly troops from Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Connecticut. And he's skeptical of them. Virginia is basically a foreign country compared to, say, Massachusetts. He writes about dirty New Englanders. He's very disparaging of the junior officers who are now serving under him. Part of the issue is that, first of all, there's an effort to weld together this brand new Continental Army into a national force by putting a Virginian in command of New Englanders and trying to merge them together. Part of the issue for Washington is that he's an immensely wealthy man with scores and scores of slaves back at Mount Vernon and overseers to take care of business for him while he's away, and he does not appreciate the sacrifice that's being made by farmers, shopkeepers, leaving their families and their shops and their farms to join him in the Continental Army for years, as it turns out, in some cases. And it's going to take him a while to appreciate precisely what it is that they're giving up, what it is that they're committing to, what it is that they're sacrificing. And this is part of the mystical bond between leader and led. And one of the interesting things about the early months in the first couple of years of the war is watching Washington come to grips with this aspect of leadership and watching his men come to grips with it, watching them appreciate that he knows in his bones what it is that they've sacrificed. So this is either going to happen or it's going to be it's a recipe for failure, because the army is the indispensable institution in this republic that's coming into being, and Washington is the indispensable man. So they have got to find a way to fit hand in glove.
That is a fascinating aspect, as you just said, that idea, the mystical bond between a leader and led, that is something that Washington does not quite understand at the beginning, you point out. And through the period that this book takes place, 1775 to 1777, he is developing that in the first years of the war.
It's true. You know, during his time as a militia colonel, first of all, he's seen quite a bit of combat, and some of it has been catastrophic. He was with General Braddock, his British commander, when Braddock's force was ambushed near current-day Pittsburgh. Braddock was killed. Washington had four bullets through his uniform coat, two horses shot out from under him. So he has heard shots fired in anger, and he knows the nastiness of 18th-century combat. Again, he has been away from the army for a long time. During the intervening time, he has been building up Mount Vernon. He's become a successful planter. He has married the richest widow in Virginia, Martha Dandridge Custis. He has built himself into a man of substance. He's become a politician. He joins the Continental Congress. So he's got to remember what army life is like. He shows up in Cambridge in July 1775. He's got a stack of books with him, the gist of which is how to run an army. So there is a learning curve here that's responsible, you know, that everyone has to tackle. One thing he's got going for him, one among many things, I should say, he's got a good eye for subordinate talent. So he identifies a 25-year-old overweight Boston bookseller named Henry Knox, who's hanging around as a volunteer. Henry Knox learns something about gunnery as a militia volunteer. He turns out to be the father of American artillery. He's got an absolute genius for gunnery. Washington recognizes that a Quaker anchorsmith from Rhode Island named Nathaniel Greene, who shows up with virtually no military experience at all, is going to be one of the great generals in American history. So being able to identify those who've got this this kernel of talent, this grit, and who, by the way, are loyal to Washington, is one of the attributes that Washington's got that will make him successful.
When you think of that success, what glimpses do we see in this period that you're writing about? When do we see him shine?
Well, we see him not shine frequently. So just as an example, the British bring a large force when Washington has occupied New York, and this is the summer of 1776. They land on Staten Island. In August, they cross to Long Island, the western end of Long Island. And in the battle for Long Island at the end of August, they completely outgeneral Washington, who has kind of misread the terrain, doesn't recognize how vulnerable his troops are. And the British slip around his left flank, and they get behind his army, and it's a rout. And Washington very nearly loses his entire army. He only manages barely to slip away across the East River when a providential fog rolls in that night. So we've seen a number of episodes like this. When we get toward the end of 1776 and he has retreated across New Jersey, his army is down to 3,000 men, he's crossed the Delaware River into Pennsylvania, he writes to his brother that I think the game is pretty near up. And then he writes to Congress, desperate times require desperate measures. He takes the desperate measure of recrossing the Delaware River to attack the German garrison, the Hessians, at Trenton, falls on them the early morning after Christmas in 1776 and defeats the garrison, doubles down, crosses the river again, gulls the British into attacking him at Trenton, inflicts heavy casualties on them, then in the night slips around the British left flank to attack the British rear guard detachment at Princeton and destroys it. This is Washington as a really pretty impressive field commander. And by this time, we have come to see that, among other things, he's an extraordinarily capable political general in the sense that he has acknowledged that Congress is his political master. He's acknowledged subordination of the military to civilian control. He's acknowledged the importance of colonial governors, state governors by this time. And he has shown political deftness in being able to maneuver and manipulate and put people in places where he wants them to be and to provide him with what he needs. So, you know, over the course of 18 or 19 months by this point, we've seen him begin to emerge as a pretty substantial force and a commander-in-chief who's worthy of the title.
Is it cynical to ask if the American Revolution was truly a revolution for freedom? We know what we read in the Declaration of Independence. We know what the aspirations were, but obviously it was not for everyone involved, was it?
It certainly was not. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Those fine words, written in 1776 by Thomas Jefferson and edited heavily by the Congress as a whole, did not apply to 500,000 black slaves, to Native Americans, to women, to indigents. Those words indeed are aspirational. You've put your finger on it. It doesn't guarantee anybody anything. This is what we believe in. This is where we hope we're headed. We have a vision of what we can be. It's a very important, beguiling vision, but it's certainly not a flesh and blood reality at the time. They're fighting for freedom in the sense that they really feel put upon by the British. There have been a series of measures before the revolution begins which are offensive to most colonials. Let's remember that probably 20% or so are loyalists. They're still loyal to the crown. Mm-hmm. That's why this will really be a civil war. It really does foreshadow the civil war of the 19th century. In some cases, they're fighting to preserve a way of life. The Southerners who are rebels or patriots They have built a way of life that is predicated on slavery. And when the British governor of Virginia, Lord Dunmore, announces that he will free the slaves of any loyalists who come and take part by taking up a musket against the rebels, this absolutely enrages the Southerners in particular. George Washington is apoplectic. Patrick Henry, there's a long list of Southern gentlemen who find this so offensive that it really galvanizes them. It gives you some idea of what they're fighting for. They're fighting for to preserve the right to keep the economy that they have built over decades and now a century and a half, which is predicated on slavery. So it's a complex melange of motivations that have welded them together. It's not all noble. And it's not all noble the way loyalists are treated by the rebels, by the patriots, by the people we think of as the Americans, when in fact the loyalists were Americans too. They're treated terribly. And this is part of our heritage. I think it's important to understand. It's important to understand that the nation was born bickering, that disputation is in the national genome. It shouldn't surprise us that we seem to have difficulty today in finding common ground. We seem to be bickering a lot. We've been bickering for a long time.
Does that make us stronger in some way?
It makes us who we are. I think today, as opposed to 2.5 million people in the country in 1775, we got 324 million or so. We're much more diverse. We're much more tolerant. We've increased immeasurably in scale. There's a lot that has changed over time, and I think, in general, for the better. But we're closer to those of founders than we realize in some cases. And I think the process has made us better and stronger. The creation of the American Republic is one of the greatest triumphs of mankind. It is our political patrimony. It's our inheritance. We should be immensely grateful for it. We should be very knowledgeable about what it is and where it came from and the sacrifices that were made to bequeath it to us and to sustain it over the subsequent 240 years. And I think that, that's an important legacy that we've got.
Let me ask you about the writing of the book and the planning of the trilogy. Was it a natural break of how the book was going, of how the trilogy was going to break out?
Yeah, I think so. The first one ends, as I mentioned, with the Battle of Princeton, early January 1777. Washington then leads his army into northern New Jersey. It's rough terrain. It's good defensive terrain. He knows the British can't get at him there. And they go to winter quarters, which is common in 18th century warfare. And not much happens for the next 5 months. They're kind of steeling themselves and licking their wounds and preparing for the spring campaigns to come. So that's a natural place to stop it. In volume two, which I'm just now starting to work on, to research, a lot will happen then. The Battle of Saratoga in the fall of 1777, critical conflict that prevents the British from being successful in coming out of Canada to toward New York, trying to cleave off New England from the rest of the colonies. It's what brings the French into the war overtly on our side and makes the Revolution a global war, really, because it's no longer just a brush fire insurrection on the edge of nowhere in North America. It becomes an international conflict. So all of that's going to happen in the second volume, which I think I'll probably end with the Battle of Charleston, which is the spring of 1780. It's a terrible defeat for the Americans. 5,000 men are captured in Charleston, and it looks like British hopes may be on the upswing, that maybe they're finally pulling it together. It's a dark moment for the American cause, and I think that's where Volume 2 will probably end.
Also, when it comes to the writing, you certainly have, and I think this was true for your last trilogy as well, but certainly in this one there's very much a you are there style of bringing us to that battleground, of bringing us to to that particular time and place. Give us a sense of the writing of that and for you getting it right.
Yeah, the New York Times once said that I am a pointillist historian, meaning like the French Impressionist Seurat, for example, who had little tiny dots of color that together, when you look at it stepping away from the canvas, come together as a coherent whole, even a narrative whole. And I'll take that as a compliment. I am looking for flecks of gold, the telling detail that really brings to life a character or a scene. It's got to be completely substantially grounded in the historical record. I'm an archive rat. I spend enormous amounts of time in various archives, dusty and otherwise. And it allows me to feel that I can take a reader into a battle scene, into a room where men are meeting, onto a farm, so that you do have a sense, I hope, that you are with them, that you are marching into battle, that you are experiencing what was being experienced at the time vividly, that you feel it viscerally. And that you understand emotionally what's happening, that there is a tremendous toll being taken on those who are fighting on both sides. That's part of my aspiration as a narrative writer, being certain that I never stray into the fictional. I think that that's critical, observing the nuances and the strictures of academic history, without being an academic in writing history. And, you know, not to say that there aren't some great academic historians, but I'm writing for, I want to be accessible. I want our history to be accessible to readers. I think it's important.
In some ways, did you see an advantage of writing so thoroughly about the Second World War and then going to the Revolution? I mean, we think chronologically, so you would think you would start with the Revolution and then work your way through. But but to go back, did you see advantages in that?
One advantage is that I've done that. I spent 15 years writing about those campaigns in Western Europe, in the Mediterranean, in World War II. And for one thing, I was able to learn how to be an archive rat, to learn that I liked it. First of all, the mystery of the next unopened archival box. The archive for World War II is enormous. Some scholar has calculated that the U.S. Army records alone for World War II weigh 17,000 tons. So it's a rich trove, and the diaries and the letters. There were 16.1 million Americans in uniform in World War II, and sometimes it seems like they all had typewriters. And so having that trove available to mine and to weave into a narrative, I think, showed me that it could be done and gave me confidence that I could do it. And so I think going back where the historical record is thinner, I think it made me think that, you know, there could be enough there and that I could mine it sufficiently to make it the same kind of vivid narrative that is compelling and accessible.
Rick Atkinson's new book is The British Are Coming, The War for America, Lexington to Princeton, 1775 to 1777, Volume 1 of the Revolution Trilogy. The book is published by Henry Holt. Rick Atkinson, a great honor and pleasure to have you on the program.
Oh, it was entirely my pleasure. Thanks for the conversation.
Thank you very much. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows, and you can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.